From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, as well as last month's airing of Public Health Radio, our guest is Francis Moore LaPaix. Over the last 30 years, Francis Moore LaPaix has looked at the factors leading to hunger and malnutrition in the developing world, and also worked to promote farming methods that are sustainable to the environment and avoid dependence on pesticides, hormones, antibiotics, and other growth stimulants that may be harmful to both consumers and the farmers who use them. We'll continue our discussion of her recent book, Hope's Edge, in which she traverses the globe, talking with citizens and activists who have worked to eliminate hunger and foster healthy communities in both the poorest and the wealthiest countries. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. The largest private health insurers in the U.S. are spending millions of dollars on marketing campaigns to attract senior citizens to enroll in their companies when the new Medicare prescription drug benefit rolls out on January 1, 2006. Remarkably, this is occurring even before the federal government has actually selected which companies will be permitted to participate in the program. The investment firm Goldman Sachs has estimated that the nine largest insurance companies will take in $10 billion during the first year of the Medicare drug program and projected a profit of about $250 million off the taxpayer-funded program. That report appears in the September 8th issue of the Detroit Free Press. However, a report appearing the next day in the Wall Street Journal projected profits nearly twice that high. The Census Bureau released data on health insurance coverage for the year 2004 toward the end of August. The number of uninsured Americans rose once again from 45 million to 45.8 million. The country's increase in population that year meant that the percentage of Americans who lack insurance coverage remained around 16%. However, that number would have been much, much higher had it not been for the large increase in the number of Americans covered through government programs, including Medicare, military health programs, and especially Medicaid. The Medicaid population, primarily designed to help the poor and disabled, increased by nearly 2 million last year. About 11% of children under age 18 had no health insurance in 2004. African Americans are nearly 80% more likely than whites to have no form of health insurance, and Hispanics are faring even worse. A third of Latino Americans had no health insurance in 2004. The number of full-time workers who had no form of health insurance increased by 500,000 last year. Once again, Texas and New Mexico were the states with the highest percentage of their population uninsured, New Mexico at 22%, and 1 in 4 Texans had no form of health insurance. Of note, the data exclude illegal aliens, otherwise Texas' proportion of uninsured would have been much higher. Minnesota and Hawaii were the only states in which fewer than 1 in 10 citizens had no health insurance coverage. The report is available at the website of the Census Bureau, census.gov. An article in last week's issue of Pediatrics reported that the rate of the often severe nervous system malformation called spina bifida has dropped by a third since 1998. That year, a regulation was passed requiring folic acid supplementation for enriched flour, rice, and pasta. The recommendation was based on research published during the 1990s, indicating that babies born to women who consume higher amounts of folic acid have a significantly reduced incidence of these neurologic deformities. Folic acid is one of the B vitamins, found naturally in raw fruits, vegetables, and in smaller concentrations in grains. The authors view the rapid implementation of this research result as a triumph for the public health in the United States. On September 13th, the U.S. Senate voted to uphold a regulation the EPA had developed regulating mercury emissions from coal-fired power plants. Incineration of coal is one of the leading sources of mercury pollution, both nationally and worldwide. The Clinton administration had planned to rapidly reduce mercury pollution over the next 5 years through a strict regulatory approach. And the EPA was set to implement that even as recently as 3 years ago. Last year, however, the Bush administration's EPA administrator announced a new rule which reduces mercury pollution only gradually over the next 12 to 15 years. Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont proposed an amendment to reinstate the EPA's previous approach, but that proposal was defeated 51 to 47 along strict party lines. Due to the relaxation of the mercury rules, children and especially pregnant women are well advised to avoid many kinds of fish, the food source that harbors the highest concentrations of mercury. Listeners interested in consuming fish are encouraged to consult the website of the Food and Drug Administration, which delineates which types of fish harbor the highest concentrations of mercury. The web address of the Food and Drug Administration is FDA.gov. Coming up next, part two of our interview with Francis Moore LaPay. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Today's show is the second in a two-part series of interviews with Frances Moore LaPay, discussing her previous work on the causes and prevention of hunger and malnutrition, and a critical analysis of the chemically dependent form of agriculture that has come to dominate farming both in the U.S. and abroad. Since the airing of last month's show, the massive disaster brought on by Hurricane Katrina has led to many stresses on the public health. Two areas of concern in the Gulf Coast region is the contamination of both the water supply and the silt and flood water that has entered the flooded homes. The short-term concern is contamination by potentially harmful coliform bacteria and other pathogens. And the longer-term concern is the silt that will be left when the water is pumped out, and the variety of chemicals, including pesticides, that that silt likely contains. Little attention has been paid to the fact that much of this toxic burden emanates from farming activities. Since the Mississippi River drains 42% of the U.S. as a whole, but a far higher percentage of the agricultural areas of the U.S., during last month's conversation with Francis Moore LaPay, we discussed both the limitations and harm caused by chemically dependent forms of agriculture. So I would like to direct listeners to both last month's show and also to the show we aired in April of this year that looked at factory farms in the Midwestern U.S. Both these shows can provide an understanding of the agricultural origins of the toxic burden that New Orleans and other flooded communities of the Gulf Coast are facing. These shows, as well as most other previous airings of Public Health Radio, can be accessed at our website, publichealthradio.org. This month, we'll be presenting the second in these pair of interviews, in which we discuss Francis Moore LaPay's thoughts on the importance of community empowerment and the special role of women in promoting public health in general and food security in particular, and also her thoughts on the relationship between corporate globalization and public health. Ms. LaPay has spent over 30 years exploring agriculture and hunger, and her work continues to influence the international debate on the root causes of hunger and poverty. Her recent work, Hope's Edge, goes beyond simply analyzing worldwide problems and focuses squarely on an array of solutions to food insecurity that active citizens have been working on in countries across the globe. Many of Ms. LaPay's books, including Hope's Edge, are available at the website of the Small Planet Institute, smallplanetinstitute.org. Francis Moore LaPay, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you so much.
So just as your book does, let's do a little travel. And I'd like to now return to Kenya. And earlier in this interview, you mentioned that there are harms from monoculture, meaning large plots of land, very large plots of land being devoted to a single crop. And obviously that provides opportunities for pests that are good at devastating that crop, and also perhaps plant diseases. But in Kenya, you point out an economic downside. The Western advisors had recommended that Kenya's climate would be very amenable to growing coffee, so they created this massive monoculture of coffee. And I was wondering if you could tell us what happened to Kenya when the Vietnamese government had discovered the same thing.
Yes, well, I'm impressed at how well you read the book. You have always...
I read this book, it's true.
Yeah. Somebody, just a side here, somebody mentioned to me recently that we should start a slow reading. You know, you've heard of the slow food movement, many of you have. Well, a friend said we should start a slow read movement so that people really, you know, go slowly through books and really digest them. So thank you for doing that with Hope's Edge. Yes, when we were in Kenya, certainly this part of Kenya that we visited around Nairobi was heavily dependent on coffee, and that was introduced by colonialists who said, oh, export crop will make you rich. And so this whole area had given up its traditional food crops and shifted to coffee. And I'll never forget this one coffee farmer we talked to. Muma was her name. And we said, yeah, you know, this can be problematic because coffee prices are, you know, go up and down and up and down in the world market. And she said, she looked at us and she said, no, they go down and down in the world market. And what she was referring to is exactly what you just said, that if a new player comes in, as Vietnam did, then suddenly, you know, the whole market went down and there were coffee refugees leaving their land, hundreds of thousands throughout the world, especially in Central America, very heavily hit. And so this farmer, Mumo, said, we worked all year. We worked all year and had zero profit from our coffee. And, you know, we can't eat the coffee beans, so we were really out of luck. And so they were questioning that whole export-dependent path and beginning to think about and actually beginning to replant some of the traditional food crops so that they could feed themselves even in downturn in international market prices. So there is definitely heavy, heavy downside for economies that have been told to grow just single export crops, which there are now huge numbers of countries in the global south that have been made dependent on one or two export crops. And those prices can be dependent on weather in some other part of the world, or as you pointed out, you know, simply a government somewhere saying, oh, we're going to invest in that particular export crop, and then suddenly your market for your prices are gone way down. I mean, can you imagine being a producer of something or trying to run, say, a store where you know, the prices for what you sell would fluctuate so widely over a year? How could you possibly run a business that way?
You visited Wangari Maathai a few years ago, and she was the founder of the Greenbelt Movement in Kenya. And she more recently gained a lot of notoriety because her group and she herself were awarded the Nobel Prize. And after that happened, the American press seemed to cover this movement as if the entire focus of the movement was to prevent the advance of the desert by planting many thousands of trees. In other words, it was portrayed as poor country environmentalist movement, something that to Westerners may seem somewhat novel. But your encounter with Wangari Maathai and others in that movement made it clear that food security and empowerment was other really important focus of that movement. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you learned there.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely. Wangari is a personal hero of mine, and when she won the Nobel Peace Prize, that was one of the moments of great, great joy for me. But then how the movement is portrayed in the press, I think, is, yes, very inadequate, because when we were there, what we realized at the genius of Wangari Maathai is understanding that trees, the planting of trees, is an entry point, as we talk about in Hope's Edge. From that entry point, they gained a sense of their own personal efficacy, their power to use their common sense to solve their problems. And from that, they started looking at the food insecurity, as we talked about just focusing on coffee. And they realized that they could plant the local food crops that are adapted to their environment, gain greater control over their lives and supply for their families, and that they began questioning the authority of this president, Moi, who at the time was, very dictatorial president, who had jailed and beaten forces had jailed and beaten Wangari Maathai for her environmental activism. And so they began to question then the authority of that government, and which helped to then lead to that government not being able to put in its place its hand-picked successor, which then led to Wangari being elected to Parliament and to now her being Deputy Minister of the Environment. So what this planting of the trees did, yes, it helped to restore the environment. It helped to provide firewood for women so they didn't have to walk 20 miles to get firewood. But it also, it very much helped them to sense their own power, which had ripples effect, ripples in all these ways that I've suggested and much, much more. So it's really a question of a democracy movement, democracy understood as this growing sense of power of regular citizens.
One of the things that was really noteworthy in the book Hope's Edge was the important role of women in many of the projects you visited around the world. This seemed to be particularly true in Kenya and in Bangladesh, but probably true elsewhere, and even in Brazil. And I wonder if what your thoughts are about whether women seem to have a critical role in the efforts to achieve food security in the projects that you visited.
Absolutely. I think you picked up something very powerful, and it was true everywhere that we went. Women were among the most creative, the most courageous, really breaking new ground. Of course, the person who stands out most powerfully in my consciousness right now is Wangari Maathai in Kenya. Here is a woman who was the first PhD in biological sciences in East Africa and realized going back there in the early 70s that the desert was encroaching, and unless Kenyans all over the country were planting trees, that they would lose their ecological home, and the whole way of life would be threatened. And so she wanted women all over Kenya to be planting trees, and the government forester said, no, the unschooled women can't plant trees. It takes foresters to plant trees. And, of course, Wangari did not listen. And she did not listen, and she proceeded ahead and told the village women to experiment, to do whatever was necessary to create nurseries, tree nurseries, and now we can say in these 30 years that 30 million trees have been planted as a result of her efforts. 30 million. By unschooled village women, I want to say.
Well, one of the striking things, though, is that it didn't seem that the empowerment of women and the mobilization of women to begin to address the problems they face in their daily lives, including hunger and food insecurity, that didn't seem to demean men, and it didn't seem that men were rebelling or rejecting this or revolting against it. Were those your observations?
Well, yes and no. I want to start by answering that with a very painful memory of our trip to India, is that the woman in India, a very powerful voice, Vandana Shiva, you may have heard of, is now an international figure pointing to the destruction that is being wrought by chemical agriculture and by consolidated centralized control agriculture. And so she's a powerful voice in India. But at the village level, as we visited villages in India, it was the men who spoke to us. But there was one exception, one near her experimentation plot in Dehradun, India. I mean, Vandana's outfit has a plot where they're doing experimentation with sustainable agriculture. There was a woman, a village woman, a poor woman, who was obviously engaged and spoke out. And this was extremely unusual in the villages and with the farmers that we spoke with. And we were so impressed with her, and my daughter photographed her, and we, in fact, took her image and put it on a card that we now send everywhere as a symbol of Hope's Edge. Well, when I went back to India then 3 years later and went back to this area to teach at this center, I asked about her because she's so much, her image is so much part of our daily life here for Anna and me. And the story is that the week that I returned, she had been murdered by her husband. And part of the story around this great tragedy is that he could not handle her being involved and speaking out and being engaged in this movement toward sustainability, movement away from chemical purchased seeds, for example, and toward the seed sharing and more biologically appropriate way to do agriculture. That leadership role was too much for him, and he murdered his wife. So that, it's, yes, women are rising to find their voices throughout the world, and they're also sometimes paying a very heavy price. So I her image is still, I have her picture right here on my desk, and to always remind me of the price that women are paying, and yet it is not stopping them.
But did you also observe the opposite, where the men in the community could see that the change efforts and the efforts,
yes,
to provide food security might be something that would benefit everyone?
Absolutely. And I still remember the scene in Brazil, for example, where, yes, men were very much in the leadership roles, but yet women in these new communities that the landless worker movement is creating, literally thousands of new farms and businesses and schools in the rural area. And while men are more prominent still, women have a very, very vital role in this process. And I remember sitting in one seminar, again, focused on sustainability and focused on development of leadership and understanding more about how economics works. And this young farmer raised his hand and stood up and said, "Now, you know, I want to say we need more women in leadership. We need more women to come to this big international meeting that we're planning. We need more women here and there." And he said, "Women are vital because they're not afraid to ask questions." And then he said, "Now, women, at our lunch break, if the men start beating up on me for saying this, you're going to come to my defense, right?" And everybody just cracked up. But it was a moment there where it was a young man saying that women have a very special role to play, and yet in this joking way recognizing that some men weren't ready to hear this, but he was willing to stand up for women's voice. So, yes, I think certainly in Africa, I mentioned Wangari, but one of the things that was visible to us in the villages was that this was not an anti-men movement. In fact, the women were expressing a great deal of concern that men didn't have the employment opportunities that they needed to give them the fulfilling life that would allow them to have more constructive relationships with their families. And so they were embracing the challenge that men were facing as well because of high unemployment and having to be away from their families and going into the cities separated from their families. So it wasn't a movement that was anti-men in any way, but it was women finding their voices, and many of the husbands extremely grateful that women were taking on this challenge of the tree planting, which then gave them firewood and gave them, in some cases, some income through their nurseries.
One of the striking things about the book Hope's Edge, which has been the main focus of our discussion, has been the remarkable array of public health problems that the book addresses. And this range from, probably most importantly, hunger and food insecurity in the poorer countries, But it really ranges quite widely. You touch on causes of the high suicide rate among farmers in the U.S. and potential some insights into the causes of the epidemic of obesity and diabetes here in the U.S., why potentially issues centering around cancer with antibiotic and pesticide, why there's so much antibiotic and pesticide use in our foods. And that impressed me very much. But I'm wondering, thinking about your writing, especially your more recent work, the book The Democracy's Edge that you're going to be publishing later this year, I'm wondering if when you think about public health, if you think that at a more fundamental level that there may actually be a relationship between personal health and public health on the one hand and democracy or power on the other hand, that what is the role of communities and democracy, and how does that relate to public health?
What a wonderful question. I think that we cannot have healthy communities unless we have what I call living democracy. In my new book, Democracy's Edge, I juxtapose, on the one hand, thin democracy, which is what we now tolerate, which is vulnerable to being taken over by narrow minorities, as is happening in the United States, being taken over by money in many ways, as Americans are so aware that, as one famous book put it, we have the best democracy money can buy. But my thesis is that there is no health, whether we're talking about literal physical health or well-being in terms of our emotional, psychological, spiritual lives, unless we have a living democracy where we all recognize that we have a voice and we are mutually accountable to one another for making our communities work in a strong, vital way. And so for me, the same things that you mentioned, for example, the obesity epidemic, which is now costing all of us a huge portion of our health care dollars, something on the order of 1 out of every 10 of our health care dollars is related to obesity associated diseases, and that is expected to get much, much more of a burden. Whether we're talking about the resistance to antibiotics, I think you mentioned that also, and I think most Americans have no awareness because they were not being told that most antibiotic use is in agriculture, is for animals, and it's not even to prevent disease, it's not even to treat disease, it's just given as a prophylactic in this very sort of broadside or broadcast approach is spread it out there, but most of our antibiotics used are for animals, and then there's a great danger that this is contributing to the antibiotic resistance, which is now an increasing problem in treating diseases in humans. So whether we're talking about these very specific instances, and of course you also mentioned pesticide poisoning, which is a very real threat for everybody in chemical-dependent agriculture throughout the world, and that was consistent as we journeyed around the world. Everyone who was directly exposed to agricultural chemicals talked about health consequences for their and their families. So I think the reason that those things are moving forward, to go back to your excellent question, the reason that we have gotten hooked into chemical dependent agriculture, or the reason for this obesity epidemic, is, I would say, is that we have not had a living democracy. We have had a thin democracy, which has been controlled increasingly by the narrow interest of a corporation looking at what is in its profits, to how are its profits served, how are its shareholders served, by, in the case of obesity, by adding those ingredients like high fructose corn syrup, which is a whole issue in and of itself, which is not so ubiquitous in processed foods, or whether it's taking out in whole grains, taking out the nutrients as processed food is processed, so that we don't get the health benefits and that we are much more susceptible to obesity. So I I'm suggesting that living democracy, where we gain a voice in economic life as well as in the voting booth, and we reclaim the voting process in democracy for citizens and take it away from moneyed interest, all of this is what I mean by living democracy that is essential to our personal health. So I think that your question is right on target, that we may, this is what my thesis is in Democracy's Edge, there is an emergent understanding that this more engaged democracy, more fair, more empowered citizen-led democracy is the only way to personal health as well as community and environmental health.
And if listeners pick up your upcoming book as well as Hope's Edge, they can perhaps find some examples of that.
Many, yes, many.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. My guest on last month's show, as well as today, is Frances Moore LaPaix, and we've been discussing her recent book, Hope's Edge. After the break, we'll be discussing several projects that are occurring in the United States to improve nutrition and farming practices, and we'll also be looking at her broader conception of the meaning of community health. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. My guest on last month's show, as well as today, is Frances Moore LaPaix, author of over 15 books on agriculture, hunger, and sustainable development. And we've been discussing her recent book, Hope's Edge. I began the second part of today's interview by pointing out that Hope's Edge is solution-oriented and not a problem-oriented critical analysis. So I asked Ms. LaPaix to describe some of the projects she visited here in the United States. Now back to the interview. The way my mind works, I tend to start with problems. This is also the public health model. And analyze problems and then try to figure out what kinds of solutions one can develop. But Hope's Edge is an interesting book for someone like me to read because you start with solutions. And then by looking at these solutions and a really wide variety of solutions, we can then think back on all the different and somewhat unrelated health problems that these empowered communities and different projects across the world have developed. So it forced me out of my usual rut of thinking and into a different way of looking at things. So for the listeners who haven't read Hope's Edge, this is a book focused on solutions. And since Public Health Radio airs in the U.S., I would like you to talk a little bit about the types of solutions that you saw in the U.S. to some of these problems, particularly in the projects in Wisconsin and in California.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me say also, Marvin, that yes, it's a book focused on solutions, but as you're saying, I just want to reinforce what you're saying, that these are solutions that cohere. And what I mean by that is that the thesis really, you get to the end of the book and there's a chapter called Traveling the Edge of Possibility, and it begins with this moment where I'm going to visit my dad in Vermont, and I get out of the car and this neighbor asks me what I'm doing, and I'm telling her about, you know, I'm writing a new book, and she said, "What's it about?" And I said, "Perception." And she said, "Oh, I thought you wrote about food." And I said, "Well, I do, but that this book is really that we need this shift in order to address our health related food problems and so many other core issues of our survival and thriving for our species and others, we need a shift in perception. And so the book is really asking the reader to shift mental map, is what we call it, so that by the end of the book, you're seeing the world through a somewhat different mental map. And so these examples, you mentioned Madison and you mentioned schools in Berkeley. Let me just say what you're talking about there, that we went to Madison, Wisconsin in part because it is the center in terms of density of examples of citizens in Madison who are connecting with the actual producers of their food, the local family farmer, and in partnership creating a more healthy life for the farmer and for the family consumers in the city. And part of that is this movement that is just brand new in the last 15 or so years called community-supported agriculture. It's really the partnership between the consuming family and the farming family, so that the consuming family, in a sense, invests in the farm at the beginning of the farming season so that the farmer is not dependent on costly loans, and there is a real human face-to-face relationship. And so children who then with their parents can visit that farm a few times a year, they know where their food is coming from. And one of my favorite stories is our farm family in Wisconsin who has this community-supported agricultural model where the families come to visit their producer. She was in town not so long ago, and a little kid, what she saw across the store she was in, grabbed his mother and said, "Mommy, Mommy, look, there's our farmer." So that child recognized this relationship of sustenance, and it's human. It's not just some corporate anonymous supplier that where we don't have any confidence in the quality and the health of our food. So this example then also connects with, in Madison as well as other cities, that there are now 400 examples of farm-to-school programs where schools, instead of buying just corporate processed food, which has the downsides of the things like high fructose corn syrup, which now we know are hazardous, and trans fats, another hazardous ingredient in much processed foods, that these school districts are buying directly from the local farmer, and so they're reinvigorating local family farming that is not chemically dependent. And then in California, we were so privileged to visit one of the first, but now there's so many more, school gardens. It's called the Edible Schoolyard, where schools are taking concrete or paved asphalt playgrounds in some cases that are not being used, or parking lots, and creating an outdoor school environment where children learn through creating the garden and the soil, bringing in whatever they need for healthy soil, and learning to plant and to harvest and then to cook and to share the food that they grow. It is a complete experience that involves learning about ecology, biology, botany, as well as how to cook healthfully and share with others. So that model, now the state of California wants to have an edible schoolyard in every school in the state. That is its goal. So this has been one of the most exciting pieces of the picture for me. And I know on our book tour, Anna and I met a woman from Tennessee. And she said, "Yes, and I've helped start 20 school gardens in Tennessee." And she said, "You'll never guess the most favorite food of the children that when they plant it themselves." And, of course, I had no idea. And she said, "It's turnips. Children love the turnips. They dig them up, brush them off or wash them off, I hope, and just eat them raw. But because the kids planted them, that is a treat." And so these expectations that we have that children just love junk food is belied by this experience. And, of course, another thing I just read recently that I wish I had put in Democracy's Edge is that, you know, if you look at school lunches in Western Europe, they're beautiful. They're nutritious. They're diverse. You know, you get all your food groups. And it's expected that children love healthy food, whereas here, the food industry, with the bombardment of advertising, somehow we've become convinced that children only eat junk food, which, of course, you know, now that, you know, I'm old enough to remember before there was much junk food around, and my parents never assumed that I would only eat junk food. So it's been so exciting for us to see this emergence just in such a short period of time of schools standing up to corporate advertising.
An even more likely group that apparently is being connected to agriculture and gardening themselves are prisoners? You just found a project that worked?
Yes, in California, and this is broader. I don't know how broad it is, but we visited what is just called the Garden Project that began and still continues within the prison environment for prisoners to actually be working the land as they are serving time so that there can be a healing of their psyches from the brutality that they've experienced by inflicting it, and most of them who've inflicted it have also been brutalized themselves, and people have found that this healing process can greatly reduce recidivism. In addition, the Garden Project operates gardens out one centrally in near where I used to live, actually, in San Francisco, a garden where ex-convicts are paid to grow food that is then often given or sold at reduced prices in the poor areas so that there can be healthy food in the inner cities. And this has been shown through a long-term study to greatly reduce recidivism. This is a process of reaching people coming out of prison who understandably are quite disoriented and need to get their feet on the ground, and give them a decent wage and benefits while they work the land, and then get the pleasure and the reward of sharing that with others. And I think this is something that we highly underestimate. I mean, those of us who've been privileged enough to have the resources to be able to share with others, just think what a joy we get when we're able to make a contribution to an organization, for example, we believe in. But most people who are very poor don't have that great reward. And so in this setup, these ex-convicts can actually be growing and then sharing and finding and experiencing that joy of giving.
In Hope's Edge, you stress the importance of connecting with local growers and encouraging them, taking a variety of actions that can help to stabilize their financial situations, and also encourage them to perhaps grow healthier food, avoiding pesticides and antibiotics. But on the other hand, some of us do live in very cold areas of the country, as I do, and to some extent, we probably are not going to be totally abandoning food from warmer climates, in particular some of the poorer countries. And you've also talked about the importance of people in the wealthier countries, such as the U.S., to think about where that food is coming from. And you gave an example of the fair trade movement. I was wondering if you could just briefly talk about that.
Yes. Again, this fair trade is a very, very simple concept that those who produce should be paid enough that they can not only just scrape by and stay alive, but actually live in some level of decency, be able to support their families, send their children to school, the most basics that human beings, of course, expect and want others to have. So fair trade is a movement that has said, we will certify, and we now have our certifier here in the United States in the last 7 years called Transfair in Oakland. We will certify that the coffee that, for example, fair trade coffee that is grown, say, in Guatemala, we will certify that the grower gets a fair price that is now $1.26 per pound, still a fraction of what we pay, and we will certify that this is done in a this coffee is produced in a democratic and a fair way among the producers themselves, and ideally in a democratic cooperative manner. And so this movement that encourages then those of the consumers of a product like coffee to look for that logo, that it's a Scales of Justice logo that appears on coffee that is certified, that the people who are getting it are paid a decent wage. And I think that it is such a common sense premise of economics that those who produce be fairly paid. And yet we know that most of the people who produce now, the clothes we wear, the food we eat, are not. They are not able in many cases to buy the very things that they produce. So this is the beginning of the most common sense effort that certainly began the year I was born, actually, 1944, with the International Labor Organization's founding. The idea was that governments would come step four and develop international protocols which protected the rights of unions and protected minimum standards and minimum pay for workers throughout the world. And unfortunately, that has been neglected. That has been bypassed. And so that just does not exist now. The United States has only signed two of those eight fundamental protocols of the International Labor Organization. So we as citizens, through movements like the Fair Trade Movement, are coming forward. We're coming forward and saying, governments have been bought off by corporate interest, and therefore we as citizens can act now to direct our purchases toward fair trade products. And union-made products is another way of looking at fair trade, that look for union-made products, and then we know that the fair wage has been paid if people are able to unionize and protect their interests that way. So this is common sense for, I think, all of us.
For those just joining us, this is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik, and our guest today is Frances Moore LaPaix, and we've been discussing her recently released book, Hope's Edge. Now back to the interview.
At several points in the book, you point out, and Anna as well, point out key disagreements and problems you have with the ideas that Tom Friedman has been espousing. And for those who don't know, Tom Friedman is talking about the flat world, and he's become the latest whiz on the lecture circuit. And I was wondering if you'd describe what your problems are with the kind of ideology he's been putting forth.
Well, Thomas Friedman puts forth a worldview that what we have now with corporate globalization is, in a sense, the end of history, that we've arrived at, if not the best, it's certainly the best we can do, this notion that economics is dominant and that we have nothing, no choice but to accept the increasing global control of a handful of corporations, and that is the economic engine and that is the solution. He writes in his previous book, he says, there is no more lemon-lime, there is no more chocolate chip, there is no more strawberry swirl. There is only North Korea or free market capitalism, in a sense. And nobody's going to choose North Korea, right? A top-down, state-controlled ideology. So all we have is this quote-unquote free market, which, of course, is not free market. It's a corporate-controlled market. But nonetheless, that's it. There's no choice. This is it. So my critique of Thomas Friedman's worldview is that he just accepts, he starts the premise that corporate globalization is the end of history. There's no alternative. And he does not address the anti-democratic sort of substance of that corporations are non-elected bodies whose boards have more control over our lives than most governments do. This is profoundly undemocratic, and they are increasingly escaping any control by democratic government as they continue to infiltrate government, certainly here in the United States, where we now have 50 lobbyists, largely from industry, for every single representative elected in Congress. So Thomas Friedman does not address the profoundly anti-democratic nature of this economic pattern, nor does he address the absolutely unsustainable aspect of it, that this increasing shipping of, you know, like, for example, we export beef and we import beef. We export tomatoes and we import tomatoes. And all of that is dependent on cheap fossil fuel, which we know is coming to an end. So Thomas Friedman ignores the absolute unsustainability of this corporate globalization approach. So he misses the two big questions for me, which is the anti-democratic nature of this system and the anti-ecology nature of this system, which is, of course, makes it unsustainable. And he misses that emergent is an alternative, which is much more democratic. All the things that my daughter and I talk about in Hope's Edge, this emergent democratic movement, which builds on local sustainable approaches where we begin to appreciate the importance of buying locally wherever we can and developing an ecologically based agriculture rather than an extractive one. So I believe, and I will argue for the rest of my life, that human beings always have choice, that that this is not a question of predetermined direction. We are only where we are because of choices that have been made, and our blindness to corporate control, which, you know, is a new form of feudalism in my view, that will become more and more obvious as corporate control becomes more and more clear to people.
You list five prevalent ideas, almost ideologies, that you view as being disempowering and that tend to undermine a sense of community as well as food security. And I was wondering if you could describe what those five, you call them myths, are and what you would view as healthier alternatives.
Well, let me just go to what I think is because they're all tied together. So I'll just mention a couple that really are the nubbin here, and that is that once we do accept this shabby caricature that's portrayed through advertising that we're nothing but these little selfish accumulators who are only materialists, and we ignore these deeper human needs to have real community, to connect with one another, and to really have an impact that affects something beyond our own survival. So if we ignore these needs to connect and affect, and we accept this shabby caricature of material selves, then we give over our fate to this magical notion of a market that automatically sorts out outcome. And we're blind to the fact that that market is controlled increasingly by a handful of corporations. So those are the primary myths that then lead us to the final one in our list of five, is the notion that we've reached the end of history, which I've just spoken to, that if you accept the idea that we're these selfish little selves, then competing in this sort of magical notion of a market, then we believe that there are no alternatives. And so we're absolutely trapped. Our hands are tied. There is no alternative. So everything in our work is about breaking us free, of helping people see that we do have choice, that we have these richer needs, that we can re-embed economic life in democratic society so that it doesn't lord over us, so that economic life is not just some automatic law that we have to obey, but is simply a mechanism that we can use to our own benefit. The market is not a law. It's just simply a tool. And in fact, what's so ironic for me is that the market depends on democratic government, because left to its own devices, any market will concentrate wealth to the point that only a few are playing. Anybody who's ever played Monopoly knows what happens, that the game ends because a few own everything. And so there is no more market, right? So to keep the game of Monopoly going, you have to have a democratic dialogue going about how you keep redistributing the parts, the pieces, so that everyone can keep playing. I mean, to keep that metaphor going, but to bring it back to society, this is what Franklin Roosevelt, one of my heroes, kept trying to tell us, is that we have to have an economic basis to democracy, because otherwise, if you don't have a democratic society, then economic life becomes so concentrated that democracy is undercut. So the market depends on our active citizenship, putting values, boundaries around the market. For one, like a living wage so that people can afford to participate in the market. Another boundary, a values boundary, would be making sure that agriculture remains in the hands of family farmers, that it is out of bounds to outside corporations to control farmland. And the state of Nebraska, for one, has decided that that is true. So really, back to the myths, the thought traps. I mean, the key ones for me are just the myth that we are nothing but these selfish accumulators, and that the second, therefore, we have to turn over our fate to this market that just endlessly concentrates wealth that ends up undermining the market, and the third myth that we're therefore just, this is it, the end of history, we can do nothing. And so I just reverse every one of those and say, no, we're just at any point we can say, we choose democracy. We choose a human dignity, if you will. And that is what I see emerging, what I call a revolution in human dignity, whether we're talking about the right to eat in Brazil, or women planting trees in Kenya, or American farmers standing up and working together with urban people to create farmers markets and community-supported agriculture and organics in order to protect the land and their own livelihood. All of these things are part of this revolution in human dignity.
And Americans often feel so passive and disempowered. So tell us other ways that they can counter that and that you want people to be empowered. That's clearly what you're saying.
Well, I think for each person, entry point may be different. I'm not saying everyone has to start with food, but I think it's a great place to start for many people. So, again, I could recommend our website, smallplanetinstitute.org, and Hope's Edge, which you've just talked about, as a place to just say, as I did, I think that, to me, the first empowerment was to be able to walk into a supermarket or walk into any environment trying to sell me something to put into my body and say, I have the power to choose what is best for my body, what's best for the earth. And that is, as I was saying to somebody yesterday who was arguing about Americans wanting instant gratification, well, I'm saying that is instant gratification, that sense of I'm not a victim anymore, I can choose based on my health. So I think that, you know, just to be able to choose a plant-centered diet grown locally that's going to make me have more energy and more vitality, and to know the ripples that every choice I'm making, I call it power shopping, to know that those choices connect me with the future that is sustainable. And then from that, also begin to make powerful political choices of who our local and international leaders are and what movements to bring to light the possibility that is right before us now, that we can end hunger everywhere in the world as we create democracy. So that is really my theme song of my life, this idea of a living democracy that involves each of us in making those choices conscious, not as a burden, but as a sense of gratifying power.
Well, Frances Moore LaPace, thank you so much for joining us on Public Health Radio.
I certainly enjoyed it. I loved your questions, and I particularly am struck by how carefully you read the book, and that's very rare in my experience of being interviewed, and it touches me deeply.
To learn more about agriculture, development, and hunger, I recommend the website of the Institute for Food and Development Policy, foodfirst.org. Listeners who would like to purchase Hope's Edge or access Frances Moore LaPace's other writing, including her upcoming book, Democracy's Edge, can go to the website of the Small Planet Institute. That web address is smallplanetinstitute.org. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.